Senate Committee on Judiciary, Monday, May 5th, 1975, 8 a.m., room 407A. Hearing on A. N. Gross Senate Bill 88, A. N. Gross House Bill 3013, House Bill 3089, Senate Bill 131, and Senate Bill 671.
Problem than others?
Yes. Yes. We've
going in several counties. As a matter of fact, there are a lot of areas, no problem at all.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Mike, for instance, in
the Lyre County, there's no, no ours really. County, the larger county, like that, I don't think there's any problem at all. There's a problem of making a killing, but that's all right. There's a lot of making a killing, but there are some counties that there's one not far from some coast, and there's some southern Oregon, and we go in those counties, and that's those there is a rigidity that's really almost impossible to change, and many times I feel that for that litigant that day, it's not a fair deal, and that's for whom the courthouse is built.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. Attorney Meyer, 3013.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Representative Hardy Myers from District 19, and I'm here to speak to the committee on behalf of House Bill 3013. I'll be very brief. This bill is a consolidation of three separate bills that were considered by the House Judiciary Committee relating to discovery in Oregon. One bill which since streamlines our present motion for production of documents to correspond to the notice or request for production of documents required under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, eliminating the affidavit, so-called affidavit of good cause. The second is a broadening of our present device for requesting the admission of genuineness of documents to extend to a request for the admission of facts, again, comparable to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, and the third portion of which is the device, the interrogatory device, which would be totally new to our procedure in Oregon in terms of a non-deposition type setting, and which again corresponds to the device provided under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. In addition to the basic discovery tools themselves, which are contained in this bill, the bill sets forth, again comparable to the federal rules, the so-called motion to compel, by which parties who have failed to respond to the request or who have responded incompletely or inadequately may be by motion compelled to respond further. Similarly, bill sets forth sanctions for parties who, without justification, either seek compulsion or resist it, again, comparable to the devices under the federal rules. And finally, the bill provides the protective mechanism by which the court can shield or protect the party from misuse of the devices, again, in a form corresponding to federal rules of procedure. I think the bill, in conjunction with the summary judgment and third-party practice bills, which were passed by the House, first two of which have already been passed by the Senate, I believe, signed with the governor, this bill, in conjunction with those, would probably make more progress in terms of modernizing our Code of Civil Procedure in Oregon than has occurred in any session for the last 50 years, and I certainly commend approval to the committee.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Back to 3089.
Good morning. I'm Clifford Olson. I'm a circuit judge from Multnomah County, and at the present time, I happen to be the presiding judge in Multnomah County, and I'm here to speak in opposition to House Bill 3089. When I came to Portland to practice law in 1957, the docket was about 2 years from filing to the day you went to trial. About that time, Judge Redding took over as presiding judge, and he instituted the system that we operate under at the present time. We have now got our docket down to the point where a litigant can reasonably be expected to go to trial within 6 months from the day his case is filed at any kind of civil litigation. In response to the direction of this legislature a couple of years ago, we have taken hold of the criminal docket as well as the civil docket, and we have been able to comply very well with the mandate that all criminal cases be tried within 60 days from the date of arrest. We could not function as we are functioning if this bill were passed. Now, we're very sympathetic, because all of us were lawyers, with the problems of lawyers and the conflicts that they have. We adjust to those conflicts. I brought along the statistics for the month of March that we keep very carefully, as Mr. Jacobs suggests. We not only keep the statistics the Supreme Court is interested in, we keep statistics for many purposes. In the month of March, we set over 53 cases for the convenience of lawyers because they had conflicts in other jurisdictions. We set over 52 cases because witnesses were unavailable, such as doctors, or witnesses were on vacation, or litigants were on vacation, or attorneys were on vacation. 52 cases. I'll just read some of the things we set cases over for. Illness of litigant to counsel, late substitution of attorneys, amended pleadings too close to the trial date, companion cases not consolidated, litigants' condition, medical condition, not stationary, need for more medical examinations, need for more depositions, cases were not at issue, and there are a number of other reasons that we find acceptable. But I think that while we'll listen to these explanations given by the lawyers, that ultimately the decision as to whether or not the case is going to be set over or not has to repose in the court, otherwise the system is unworkable. I was a lawyer for 19 years before I became a judge. I know full well that if I were practicing law today and I wanted to put over a case for some very selfish reason, that would be unacceptable by anybody's standards. And if Mr. Jake were on the other side, I could be assured that he would agree that I could set that case over, even though it may not be in the best interest, the truly best interest of his client to do so. As long as he was not injuring his client, he'd be inclined to go along with it. This is the way the legal system works. We all know it. We all recognize it. And I know that if this bill were passed, our docket would immediately be back in the 2 and 3 year range before we would be going to trial in our cases. And I urge you with all my heart and soul not to pass this bill out to the floor.
Yes. Judge, I have the same feeling, and it's a feeling at this point, that John talks about some counties, there doesn't seem to be a problem, but there does exist a problem apparently in some counties. If this bill is not passed, what mechanism would you recommend to, if in fact there is a problem, and I believe there is?
Well, there is. I've practiced in the same counties that Mr. Jacobs practiced in. I think that I practiced in every county of the state before I became a judge. And I know in Coos County, for example, they were very inflexible, and probably still are. It caused great inconvenience sometimes. It created some hardship. I might say that we've all survived and our clients survived, and I can't think of one instance when our clients were hurt because of the assistance of the Coos County people who push it forward. And I don't think that that is a satisfactory answer. I think something should be done. I think the solution should come out of the judicial council. They're working on it. We have a committee right now who handles very what seems like a simple problem of conflict between counties. The two counties have a demand on a given lawyer on the same day. How do you resolve it? We are the largest county. We have probably 50% of the litigation in the state. So we get confronted with this problem more than most. We have developed a rule, which is very flexible, that we will yield to the older case. In some counties, they don't have that flexibility. So I get on the telephone and I plead the lawyer's case to try and make this thing work. I think that the judicial council has, we have inflate the statistics that Mr. Jake would suggest. We're all trying to make a good showing. We're all trying to show that we're busy and worthy of more money. But I think that we as judges have got to recognize that we can't be as busy as we have been in some areas in the past. In Multnomah County, because we have perhaps a greater volume of cases, we can be a little more flexible than some of the other counties. But at the same time, I've never been forced out, absolutely forced out to trial in a situation, even in Coos County, where it was not in, and I could make a showing that it was in the, not in the best interest of my client to go to trial. Even there, the judges would listen to it.
Yes, I'm glad I'm here when you're here. Last time the judge was here, I wasn't present. He began to wonder if I was a member of the committee.
Not alone.
Yes. I didn't hear your first testimony, but when the judge from Marion County, what's her name now?
Judge Slagle.
She was wondering too, maybe.
Judge Slagle was here earlier testifying on this bill, and I asked her if she would object to this bill if we were to amend it. To provide that any stipulated delay could not exceed 30 days, and that such agreement or stipulation to delay the trial of a case had to be signed by the client, the idea being so that it couldn't be interminable, and also so that the client had to specifically approve of the delay, and this couldn't be a device where incompetent or careless lawyers just simply put the day of reckoning off. What would be your view on that?
Well, it wouldn't work in Multnomah County at the present time. This morning, starting at 9 o'clock, Judge Dale will be setting some cases over. Without making a special setting, in other words, moving someone else off the docket, we're setting cases to trial that are set over today on June, probably about the 28th of June. So you're talking about almost 2 months. That would be the earliest that we could accommodate. So you're not talking about a 30-day delay. We couldn't accommodate for that. You'd have to make it at least a 60-day delay in Multnomah County. And I think that, in some cases, that's unfair to the litigant.
What if the litigant has the opportunity to approve or disapprove?
You've got two litigants, and you have to get approval from both litigants. Well, as I just mentioned to the members of the committee, I think that you understand that in Multnomah County we do accommodate the problems of the litigants and the attorneys. I just enumerated the various reasons that we set cases over. And, Senator Cook, you know full well that if you cannot go to trial because you don't have your doctor, or if you don't have a witness, or your witness, or your client needs further medical care, whatever the situation is, we will see that case is set over and your final isn't sent out to trial. On the other hand, having come to our call many times, you know that some lawyers stand up and they're insincere in the reasons that they have. Had one the other morning, and that attorney stood up and said, divorce action, where the heat is great. And the, what they call now, petitioner's attorney said, we're not ready to go to trial. And I asked why. He said, well, my client's up in Washington. She doesn't want to come. Now, you know, if this were done, not in open court, but were done by agreement of the litigants and the attorneys, perhaps that case would not have gone out to trial. Now, that's a totally unacceptable reason for a lady who filed a divorce action and her husband is interested in terminating the proceedings, why that case should be delayed. I require the lady to come down from Washington and have her trial, and the case was disposed of as it should have been, expeditiously and I'm sure properly. And I'm confident, Senator Cook, that if this bill were passed, that Multnomah County would not have the marvelous reputation it has nationwide for being a place where a person can get expeditious resolution of the litigation. And, as I mentioned, that was instituted this system back in 1957. Our performance was improved steadily, and one of the reasons is that the ultimate decision as to whether or not a case is going to go out has to repose in the presiding judge.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Judge Rodman. I'm Roland Rodman, the circuit judge in Eugene. I don't think I have a lot more to add to what Judge Olson said. I certainly agree with everything that he did say. I think that enactment of the legislation would be a serious handicap to the judges in administering the docket. The biggest complaint around the country about the administration of justice is the delay, and I'm convinced that enactment of the bill would result in some further delay. I'm not sure that Judge Olson touched on the matter of keeping our courts with cases before them. I couldn't get to well from where I was. This also would be a very big problem. We would have cases set for trial, a certain number of cases set for the number of courtrooms we'll have available for that day, and find out that one or more cases by this stipulation simply will come off. Some years ago, we calculated in Lane County that it cost $500 a day to keep one circuit court going. So if there's a judge that doesn't have a case and is otherwise available for a case, it's a very considerable expense.
Judge, I don't know whether you've heard Judge Olson, but he suggested that my question ought to depend on you. We don't pass this bill, and there are, in fact, certain districts where the courts are inflexible when it comes to asking for a continuance. Do you think, he suggested the judicial council or conference or whatever would be the appropriate means to attend this problem? That's your feeling?
I do, and I would also suggest the Judicial Administration Committee of the State Bar. And incidentally, there is Dick Martin is here and didn't have a chance to sign up. He's here. I'm not sure whether he can take representing the Judicial Administration Committee, but there's an opposition bill in any case. There may be, it's not a very good one. I don't suggest it's a very good remedy of mandamus. I've been mandamus, and the presiding judge of Multnomah County has been mandated by the same lawyer on different cases. In the case I had, the case had been previously postponed at that lawyer's request about five times. On the sixth request for postponement, it was denied, and she chartered mandamus in the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court didn't entertain that. If there are cases that truly have merit, or if it can be shown there's true abuse of discretion, then maybe mandamus is the remedy. But I would suggest that this matter, of course, didn't have an opportunity to come before either the Judicial Administration Committee of the Bar or the Judicial Conference. And I would suggest that the legislation that was considered by those groups and then presented to the legislature would be the best course to follow. He mentioned the number of postponements in Multnomah County. I pulled out the statistics for 1 month, which last January we set 244 cases for trial in Lane County. Of those, 56 of them were postponed. So there's certainly a substantial number of postponements being granted.
Thank you, Judge.
Judge Clayton, did you want to say anything? I think I've already settled this bill. I'm
doing
another one.
Oh, okay. Richard Barton.
Morning. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Committee on Judicial Administration. I must echo what Judge Olson and Judge Rodman said. Our committee was not presented with this matter. Be there a sour apple in the barrel somewhere in the state, it is not a reason, as far as I consider it personally, to change the entire statutory scheme of setting cases. I think it is definitely an appropriate matter for consideration by the bar and also by the judicial conference. And if necessary, I think the Supreme Court has rulemaking power that could adopt a statewide requirement that the older case take precedence on the docket if there are multi-county conflicts. And I would urge this committee to not let this bill reach the floor in its present form or even in a 30-day continuous form, as Senator Cook suggests. It would wreak havoc in Multnomah County, and I suspect in the other counties as well. So if there are any questions the committee has.
Madam Chairman? I missed the first 15 minutes today of this meeting. Was there testimony where the argument that the main reason for this bill was because of the failure of certain judges to recognize the older cases? That wasn't brought up the other day.
I missed it too, Senator, so I can't say.
Mr. Jake would testify that two where the daughter was attending a convention and they refused to give him a
maybe we ought to amend this to be able to subpoena the doctors. That would solve a lot of problems. Seriously, the doctors create more problems than their lawyers.
Thank you. I'm Jenna Schlegel, Circuit Court Judge from Marion County. Here to support and grow Senate Bill 88. While the bill in the present form states what I believe to be the law by virtue of the fact that there has had to be litigation, it apparently is not clear that this is presently what the law is. And I therefore would endorse the effort of the legislature to codify it to avoid further litigation. As I understand it, the bill was introduced to codify the results which arose out of the Wyatt versus Myers case, which is in my courtroom, which I attended to read out this evening.
Don't you think I don't know if the sponsor of this bill drafted it, but
it was substantially amended in local government, in fact almost deleted and restated.
Well, I wonder three. I wonder why they put subsection 3 in there, lines 19 to 21, because we don't need a statute to say that. That's what the Constitution says.
I asked, it's my understanding that the administrative assistant, and I've forgotten his name,
John White.
Sorry, for local government and election.
John White.
Okay. I raised that question with him when he showed me the proposed amendments to this bill before it was engrossed, and pointed out that was simply saying in the statute what the Constitution, I think, already says, and he said it just made it clear.
Now,
I don't know what to read.
Can I speak to that?
Yeah.
And that's precisely it, is that you can get to that same position as Marion County Circuit Court and the Supreme Court has reached upon occasion. But it's always raised, in almost every case, the issue is raised, and the thought was, although it suffers from redundancy, it makes it very clear in the statute that, and we felt that it was a part of putting it into 249 makes it very clear that once you get past the November election or past the nomination stage, then the House and Senate determine whether or not you move forward.
So what you're saying in this bill is apparently what Judge Schlegel said in her decision, that if one gets certified as elected, then even Judge Schlegel can't do anything about it. It's going to be purely up to the to the House, which apparently in the case of Keith Burns, where he represented Thunderlip versus Groner, I think was the case.
Groner, the Groner case, yeah,
yeah.
In 1969.
And in that case, the court held that the courts can't do anything about that. But it still leaves the opportunity open, as was done in the case of Cook versus Corbett. Anyway, this doesn't close that door.
The primary door.
Primary door, right.
Madam Chairman, there is some thinking, I understand, in the Elections Committee to perhaps change the constitutional provision and put it on the ballot that the courts are deciding after the general election in the case of violations of the
election. Well,
is
that
rinky? Yes, the house to which the person is elected, and therefore I would object to having this kind of language in statute, and because of the notion that perhaps we even ought to change it totally about who's going to determine the qualifications of the election court.
No, I don't. It's not to my knowledge. Could I ask Mr. Bannon if you're user Senator Roberts?
Yeah.
I don't remember that bill at all.
There's no bill, but it's been discussed.
Doing what, Betty?
To change the Constitution to allow the court to determine the qualifications if, in fact, there has been a violation of Corrupt Practices Act, and let the court take on that responsibility rather than
You know, Madam Chairman, on that same subject, though, what do you think, would it be constitutional to allow, could we by statute provide a hearing to bring about a finding by the court as to whether or not the representative or senator-elect had in fact violated the law, whatever it was, which, although they didn't have the power to remove that person, would at least allow, in effect, a declaratory judgment which could then be looked to by the House in its determination. In other words, it seems I kind of agree with Senator Roberts that really just leaving it up to the House and the Senate is usually a pretty empty remedy, especially if the one who's being challenged is a member of the majority of that particular House. Well, yeah, I don't, you know, I voted against Senate Bill 381 because I don't think we ought to interpret our laws and say what the regulations should be. We're not, all of us are not judges. Likewise, I don't think we're really, as a body, necessarily qualified to determine legal issues. Now, I wonder, could we have legislation that would give to a court the power to make a factual determination? And then they hand it to the legislature. Here it is. Cook just violated the Corrupt Practices Act. All right. Again. Now, here's the hot potato. We aren't going to throw him out, but are you going to seat him in spite of the fact that he violated the Corrupt Practices Act?
I would suspect, Senator Cook, that you could probably do that already under the, and this is off the top of my head because I haven't looked at the statute, but just under the Corrupt Practices Act, you can have a trial where these findings are made, and if it happens to be a member of the legislature, then the court cannot remove that person from office if they've been elected by virtue of what happens in the trial, but damages can be assessed or fine imposed, that sort of thing. So that probably would accomplish. This particular bill, as I understood it, really wasn't attempting to get embroiled in the issue of whether legislators should or should not be removed by someone other than their own body.
So we could
agree
without it bothering you very much.
It wouldn't bother me anymore. Because the guts of it is really found in subsection 1.
Father Wally.
Please bless you.
Yes, Madam Chairman. I just would like to add one thing if I could.
I'm Jim Markey, for the record, representing Oregon Association of Chiropractic Physicians. Most of you know I've testified on the bill before. I just want to make one thing very clear. There are several bills floating around the legislature that speak to similar sorts of situations regarding insurance companies covering specific people of the healthcare team other than MDs. And I've listened to a lot of testimony and a lot of hearings about those bills. And I always hear that it's bad to mandate to an insurance company what they will cover. And I think that there's kind of a fine line that we should really look at. This bill really does not mandate any specific coverage in any given insurance policy. Coverage is there. This bill, if you look at the exact wording, says that an insurance company or other health insurance contractor would have to pay a chiropractor for his services rendered if the coverage of that policy covers ailments that are within the scope of his practice. So we're really not talking about adding any additional coverage. We're only talking about who should be paid for the coverage. We're talking about the right of free choice of a consumer to choose the type of physician that he wants to go to. And I said this before, that this sort of thing does not add anything to the premium of the insurance policy involved. We did a national study that we went out nationwide, and the results were that the inclusion of chiropractic coverage, that is, paying chiropractors as opposed to paying MDs only, but paying them both, did not add to the premiums whatsoever. I just wanted to make that very clear.
Can the group opt in or opt out on this?
Well, certainly.
So the group would have an opportunity to say yes, we want it, or no, we don't want to pay for that.
Under present law, Senator Roberts, it is possible for a group to negotiate chiropractic coverage. However, there are some specific problems involved with that. OPS and Blue Cross for many years took a position that they simply would not cover chiropractors. Now they have changed that a little bit. In certain cases, they do cover chiropractic coverage, and they'll tell you that. But a typical example, my father is covered under the IWA, International Woodworkers contract, and they negotiated a health contract with OPS. And that policy pays for a member physician of OPS, that's an MD that's a member of OPS, they pay 100% of everything. If he goes to a non-member MD, they pay 90% of everything. And if he goes to a chiropractor, they pay $4 per office visit. They limit the number of visits, I think it's about 80 years, and they pay absolutely no x-rays or anything. Now, it happened that my mother, under this policy, went to a chiropractor, had extensive treatments, incidentally was cured of the disorder, but was stuck for some $95 in x-rays, as well as part of the office cost. Had she have gone to an MD for that same treatment, the entire thing would have been paid for.
Yeah, sir. I don't think you answered Betty's question specifically, Jim. Now, if this were passed, would it still be the option of the negotiating group, like the IWA? Could they negotiate the contract either with or without the coverage for the chiropractor?
It's my understanding that if this law were passed, every consumer would have the right of free choice to go to a chiropractor or an MD. There would be no negotiation.
Every insurance plan would cover coverage. Do you have anything more that you want to say on the extended warranty?
It's 131, isn't it?
671,
yes. This is another bill that says, when I said
testified before on this bill, there were some of the members that weren't here, and I just signed up in case there were any additional questions regarding the practice of obstetrics. I might add that I, since last time I talked with this committee, for those who don't see the bill in front of you, this bill simply says the chiropractors and nurses have not practiced obstetrics. I covered this rather fully last time, but since last time that I talked to the committee, I spoke with the lawyer who has represented the Oregon Association of Chiropractic Physicians for some 20 years. He informed me that in his 20 years of service with the association, there have been a total of 2 malpractice cases related to obstetrics practiced by chiropractors. And I think that's a pretty fair record, and I thought the committee should know that.
Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman. I'm going to ask Jim a question on 131 again, and that is, if 131 were amended so that it would be optional with the purchaser, that is, with the IWA or the group negotiating the contract, whether chiropractors would be compensated in this situation or not, would you still support the bill?
Well,
I'm not saying it'll be optional with the insurance company. If the option were given to the IWA to determine whether or not the contract had to include and the provision to pay chiropractors or not, would you still support the bill?
I would support the bill if the premium were not based upon that decision made by the group requesting the coverage. Because the evidence seems to me quite clear that there is no additional cost factor involved in the insurance company's coverage. So, as long as the insurance company could not say, yes, it's your option to cover this, however, if we do cover chiropractic coverage, we're going to charge you an extra whatever the cost is, I don't think that would be right. If the option were strictly with the group requesting the coverage and the premium was not to be changed as a result thereof, then certainly I would still support the bill.
Jim, are you aware whether or not, when I was out of the room, I had to talk to Mr. Crawford and we discussed, maybe my guess, 131. the concern, what are the Blues doing now, keeping with Senator Cook's thought? Is your understanding that if the Oregon State Employees Association asked to have chiropractors included, they would or would not? Do you have any feeling on that?
Both OPS and Blue Cross, both their boards are dominated by MDs who are members of the Oregon Medical Association. And first of all, 80% of all private insurance carriers cover chiropractic. But when you get to the Blues, you reach a point of philosophical argument. OMA, philosophically, is opposed to chiropractic. I have letter after letter that says, you know, last year we had a symposium sponsored by Workman's Comp over here. Now, chiropractors are a provider under Workman's Comp. This symposium was to speak about back-related problems for the workers. And when OMA saw that there was a chiropractor on that program, they totally withdrew their support and requested that no MD appear on the same program with a chiropractor. And the reason was that we in no way want to condone chiropractic, nor do we want to expose any patient to the, quote, cultist practice of chiropractic. And that's their position. And as long as that's their philosophical position, and they're certainly entitled to that position, they're going to be very reluctant to include chiropractic coverage in any policy. Now, it's true they have, in some cases, included it, but I think it's been done very reluctantly. Blue Cross now covers state employees, but that was mandated. Had they have had the choice, I'm sure they wouldn't have covered
it. Mandated by the
state.
We want by the employees. What if I wanted to buy my own article? What do you probably prefer to ask you? Have you heard? I'm not in a big group. I just want a health insurance policy.
I don't know exactly what the policy is with respect to that. I know that. Again, in 80% of all private insurance carriers, you would automatically have it. It seems
are, in many cases, decisions being made by insurance companies which don't seem to make much sense. We talk about inclusion or non-inclusion of chiropractic coverage, and we, OMA has consistently said, we have a problem with, for instance, Clackamas County Physician Service, because they are not in a position to cover or to pay chiropractors. And yet I have Dr. Bolin, the president-elect of our association, sitting in the back of the room, who a month ago was the first chiropractor. For some reason, someone in that organization made a decision that they were going to pay him for treating the patient. They paid him over $300 for treating this patient. So all of a sudden, you know, we have a lot of consumers out there with that same exact policy who have not been allowed to be treated or to be, have their chiropractic physician be reimbursed. For some reason, this individual did. Maybe he knew somebody in the company. I don't know. But that's a, you know, that's a weird sort of decision for an insurance company to be making.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, perhaps I can answer a couple of the questions that were raised. And I'm sorry that I was not here at the previous hearing and had not testified formally. Any Blue Cross policy holder may have chiropractic coverage if he chooses, whether he is an individual or whether his group buys it. Now, the only people who have the problem are those people who are in groups that elected not to include chiropractic coverage. Along the line of Mr. Sunder Cook's question, if this law were to require the Blues to offer chiropractic coverage, which is what I think you really were getting at here, to make it available, there'd be no question at all, it's already being done. On the matter of whether or not there's a difference in rates, I'm sorry, I do not have the statistics. I gave them to the House Human Resources Committee, and I'll get them back for you if you like, on the difference in cost. In the Blue Cross statistics, we find that there is a difference of several dollars in the average x-ray cost when done by a chiropractor rather than being done through the x-ray clinics and so on, to which they are assigned by MDs.
Over or under?
Higher.
Is it higher with the chiropractor?
Yes, sir. And I'll get those statistics for you if you would like. I will. It is the opinion of Blue Cross, and incidentally, their board is not dominated by by MDs. I will bring you a list of the board members, and the majority are not MDs. There are a substantial number of lay members of the board. Perhaps it might be a little advantageous to know the background of these organizations. During the early days of the Depression, when people were having a tremendous problem with hospital costs, the Hospital Association put together a program called Blue Cross to permit people to pay in advance for their possible hospitalization. About the same time, the medical profession, through the Oregon Physician Service, did exactly the same thing, called OPS. Well, over a period of time, both of these have spread out to where they cover each other's fields. Originally, Blue Cross covered only in-hospital costs, and OPS covered only medical costs to the doctor. Then they gradually became full-service operations, and still are. And there is no question, there is strong feeling among some doctors as to the chiropractic profession. We do not feel that is true on Blue Cross's board. We do not feel that it shows up in our policy. When you talk about mandating, and you heard someone mention the IWA, and believe me, this would mandate coverage into every policy, whether the group wanted it or not. And incidentally, on the state employees, the employees wanted it. And that's why they got it. And it's only, I believe, I'm not sure that it's in every one of the plans. I think it's in certain of the plans, but it may be in all of them. I could be wrong on that. But if the chiropractic profession had spent as much money in educating the public to the need for chiropractic treatment as they have spent in a, since I've been around the legislature and attempting to pass this bill, I believe they'd be in almost all the policies. I have nothing against chiropractic coverage. I go to chiropractors occasionally. Depends upon what I think my problem is at the moment. And on the matter of cost and on the matter of coverage, I would like to point out that they did not say here, at least at this hearing, that Medicare and Medicaid cover chiropractic treatment. They do. And if this committee should decide to pass this bill, then I would urgently suggest that you incorporate in this bill the same amendment, an amendment which would give the same kind of protection and the same kind of requirement for chiropractic coverage on the Oregon state level that is involved in Medicare and Medicaid. And I can get you a copy of that, of an amendment that would do that. I also gave that.
What does that do?
It requires that the chiropractic coverage be paid for treatment which is identifiable upon an X-ray.
Well, there's very little MD's treatment is identifiable upon an X-ray. Isn't that kind of unfair?
Now, you've heard that this should be for treatment which comes within the purview of the chiropractic license. Now the question then determines is who determines what that purview is.
Doesn't the State Board of Chiropractic do that, which is a state agency?
What is an identifiable illness? This is where you get into the rate problem.
Yes, but you don't require that with MDs under these coverages. Hell, there's not one in ten things that a doctor, an MD, does for a person that could be identified by an X-ray or by objective anything.
I think you will find, however, that the licensing of a chiropractor is directly related to those functions of the body where damage are generally considered to be identifiable on an X-ray.
Muscle? You can't see a muscle.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm not an expert on chiropractic, but I did not realize that it was just muscles that we were talking about.
No, but that's one of the major areas, and you can't see a muscle on an X-ray.
Well, is that
I mean,
one
it has to do with the functions of the back and so on. And bones, yep. You can't. About all you can see on an X-ray, I think, is broken bones.
I've been to a chiropractor for many times, and I have never yet felt that what I was in there for was treatment of muscle problems.
You weren't doing anything to your bones.
You might ask them. I wish you'd ask them that question. I will get that material for you.
3013, Austin McCrone. Austin McCrone for the Oregon State Bar. I'd like to supplement just briefly what Representative Myers said. House Bill 3013 includes two sections which were originally bills recommended by the Oregon State Bar, namely the section on admission to fact and the section on written interrogatory. As members of the committee probably realize, under the present law that we have, ORS 41-625, a party may not request another party to admit anything other than the genuineness of relevant documents or physical objects. And what we're trying to do by this bill is to expand that to particular facts. The section concerning written interrogatories is an attempt to modernize or make feasible and practicable the provisions of the present law on written interrogatories, which are included in ORS 45-320 to 370. As of the present time, in order to obtain answers to an interrogatory, it's necessary to first of all use the court, have a commissioner appointed, and be sure that the counsel for both parties are excluded. And just briefly, I wanted to explain to you that in a case that I'm involved in at the present time, the plaintiff's attorney attempted to use the present procedure we have for interrogatories, and on December 9, he sent the written interrogatories to two of the three corporate defendants. It's a product liability case, and he needed to find some information from the two manufacturers, one in California and one in Connecticut. He went through this procedure and sent the questions back there, and it wasn't until March 4th that one of the answers came back, and April 24th that the other one came back, and it turned out that under the specific requirements of the statute now, there was some technical reason that the commission wasn't perfected properly, and so it was going to be necessary to fly the people out here for the trial in order to verify that they did give those answers that were given on the interrogatory. basically what we're trying to do is to reduce the cost of litigation rather than requiring you to go back to East Bay to take the deposition of an individual or have the person fly out here to trial, give you the right to ask questions at the time during the discovery period of the case so that you can get this information that can be made available for the lawsuit. I think this is the main purpose that these two particular portions of the bill are directed at. I should individually perhaps indicate a couple of things regarding the provisions of the bill that Representative Myers did not mention. On the last page, page 8, you'll note that subsection 2 in section 11, subsection 2 is added, and the main purpose of this is to set forth exactly what the scope of depositions are. Ironically, the statute as it exists today, which you can see in subsection 1, is supposed to define the scope of a deposition, but it doesn't do that, and the courts have had to interpret it in their own language, and what they have done is said, well, we think that what the legislature meant was to use the language that's now contained in subsection 2, so this is merely sort of a housekeeping book, a housekeeping measure. As far as the other portions of the bill, it was the feeling of the House Judiciary Committee that what should be done is attempt to take production of documents, interrogatories, requests for admission, put them all in one section, have enforcement procedures so they're all organized, and also provide that everybody in the lawsuit gets a copy of all these things so they know what's going on. I think basically in conjunction with some of the other things that the legislature has passed this session, this would provide an additional tool which would reduce the cost of litigation to the parties and help facilitate the determination of issues in a case on a factual basis rather than go along with the old adversary system where you want to surprise your opponent at the time of trial. Thank you.